Support for this podcast is provided by Clark University's International Development, Community, and Environment Department. Administrations change. Global problems persist. Innovate solutions to global challenges like climate change, hunger, inequity, and injustice. Turn research into action. Apply at clarku.edu/IDCE.
The Fortune Cookie Thief, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. On a special and mysterious Christmas edition of the show, our reporter tries to find out what happened to hundreds of fortune cookie fortunes.
The garage was filled with cardboard boxes, so many that it would have been impossible to close the door without some serious rearranging. And next to one of the boxes, I noticed a little white rectangular slip of paper.
I think those slips...
Oh my God, yes! There are fortunes all over the floor.
We'll dive into that mystery today. Plus, man, oh, Manischewitz.
Horrible. It's sweet. It's syrupy. It's gaggy. And so no one ever wanted to drink the Manischewitz because it tasted like cough syrup.
Those stories ahead on a very merry edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Welcome to you all on this Christmas Day, which started out here in Boston as a freezing wet Christmas and gradually shifted to a blowy white Christmas, visibility of 50 feet. Anyway, memories for some of you, nasty driving for others. Whatever the weather today, where you are, frightful or uneventful, thanks for being here. And as you gather around the table with your family for dinner, you may think some of them are crazy. But let me introduce you to the Greek tragedy that is the Fujimori family in Peru. Alberto Fujimori, or Fujimori if you're in Peru, former president in jail for corruption and human rights violations. His two children, also political players who have sharply divergent feelings about dad. But I get ahead of myself. So let's start with the latest. Alberto Fujimori was pardoned last night. Reporter Simeon Tagle is on the line from Lima, Peru.
He was serving a 25-year jail term for various high crimes and misdemeanors, corruption, human rights abuses, that kind of thing. He's 79 years old, and he was in a clinic last night. He'd been taken from jail to the clinic, and President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski decided to pardon him, a humanitarian pardon on the grounds of ill health. So he was released immediately, and that has caused uproar here in Peru. Fujimori is a very polarizing figure here. He's revered for having crushed the Shining Path terrorists, among other things. But also many, many people loathe him for the corruption and his authoritarian style.
Yeah, I mean, it's been described as a humanitarian pardon, but today, protests on the streets of Lima, is that right?
Yeah, there were impromptu protests in downtown Lima last night. People I just saw on social media, within an hour of the decision being made public, people were just posting, right, I'm going downtown to protest. And I think there's going to be a lot more of this as well.
All right, let me jump in and give you some context for the craziness. Fujimori has a son and a daughter who are both in government. His son Kenji has been campaigning for dad's pardon for years, but his other child, a daughter named Keiko, has been estranged from her father. Okay, here's the plot twist. Keiko is in charge of an opposition party in Peru, and she's been leading an effort to get the current president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, impeached. Kuczynski being the same man who pardoned Alberto Fujimori last night. Still with me? Anyway, President Kuczynski is accused of doing some pretty shady stuff. Back to Simeon Tagle.
So it emerged around 10 days ago that a consulting firm that or an investment banking firm owned by Kuczynski had been receiving payments from Odebrecht, which is the Brazilian construction company at the heart of this huge corruption scandal that's pretty much covering all of Latin America. And these payments came at a time when Kuczynski was previously finance minister and also prime minister. So the allegation was that he was corrupt, or these were bribes of some sort to give contracts for public construction projects to Odebrecht.
So Keiko Fujimori, the daughter, has been trying to oust Kuczynski. That impeachment vote last week, which was widely expected to succeed, failed at the last moment. Why? Because Keiko's brother, Kenji, worked against her. He went behind the scenes and got 10 representatives to switch their votes. And this is where it gets really interesting, because last night, just a couple of days after that impeachment vote failed, President Kuczynski pardoned Fujimori, the former president. So people are calling this a quid pro quo, The brother, Kenji, got the vote to fail so the father would be pardoned.
It's kind of a little bit like a Greek tragedy or something like that with the Fukimori family right now.
That's Simeon Tagel again. Amid all this drama, he says, keep this in mind.
I think the bigger background just to mention is that democracy here is really fragile. It's only been 17 years since Fukimori himself was ousted and democracy returned. So a lot of public institutions here are pretty weak. When you look at the approval ratings for Congress, political parties, the president, and Keiko Fukimori herself, they all have very low ratings. So I think Peruvian democracy is in something of a crisis right now, and it's really hard to see how or who might be able to restore confidence in democratic institutions here.
And I didn't even tell you the part about how one of the doctors in charge of deciding whether Alberto Fujimori is sick enough for a medical pardon might have lied. But for that, we'll have to wait for next Christmas. Here are some wise words for the holiday season. Drink in moderation. No need, though, to report in moderation about drinking. So here are two stories about alcohol. The first one is about Manischewitz. That's a brand of sweet kosher wine that you'll often find in Jewish homes during Passover and other holidays. And in some other, perhaps unexpected places, too. Reporter Nadej Green at WLRN in Miami tells us more.
About a year ago, I was scrolling through Instagram and saw that someone had put up a picture of a billboard in Haiti advertising Manischewitz wine. Glenna Milberg, a TV journalist in Miami, had posted it while reporting in Haiti.
And right in front of me is this Manischewitz poster. I said, stop, stop, I gotta get out. And I think the caption I put under it was something like, a kosher Creole connection, who knew? Which is kind of a Jewish way to say things anyway, who knew?
Milberg grew up with Manischewitz wine, a kosher staple. In Jewish circles, there's nostalgia for it, but it's not exactly considered a fine wine. Among some people in the Caribbean, though, it's beloved. That surprised Milberg, who definitely does not like it.
Horrible. It's sweet, it's syrupy, it's gaggy. And so no one ever wanted to drink the Manischewitz because it tasted like cough syrup. Please, no disrespect to Manischewitz.
I also grew up with Manischewitz wine, and I'm not Jewish. It's just that my Haitian mom really liked it. So when Milberg asked, who knew? I did, and so did Hazel Bethel. She says for her,
Manischewitz is put in most everything.
Bethel is originally from Trinidad, but has lived in the Miami area for years. She drizzles Manischewitz over ice cream.
Get some cherry ice cream and some Manischewitz. It's the bomb.
She might spike her morning drink with it.
Mix your coffee.
She adds it to her traditional holiday fruitcake called black cake.
I have some black cake soaking right now with some Manischewitz.
And if she's just in the mood for a glass of wine.
Manischewitz, of course. Manischewitz.
When Bethel moved to the U.S. from Trinidad, she first settled in New York, where other Trinidadian expats introduced her to Manischewitz wine. Many of her friends worked as housekeepers or caretakers in Jewish homes.
You see it there. So the next thing you know, you go and buy it, and it's cheap.
It probably became popular in the Caribbean by way of the diaspora in the United States. Last year, the Wall Street Journal ran a story about its popularity in Asian American communities. And in the 1950s and 60s, it was also a popular wine in the African American community.
Sammy Davis Jr., who converted to Judaism at some point, endorsed Manischewitz.
Jay Buxbaum is director of wine education at Royal Wine Corporation, one of the top kosher wine importers. The company is not affiliated with Manischewitz. He says when Jews first arrived to New York, they needed wine for most religious ceremonies and holidays.
The only grapes that were available were something called the Concord. Those grapes, unlike European grapes, are actually quite sour. They're not sweet. So in order to make them palatable, they would make this very sour grape into wine, and then they would add sugar.
This is fresh, so.
Hazel Bethel is pouring a glass of sorrel over ice. Sorrel is a traditional Christmas drink in the Caribbean, made from hibiscus blooms, ginger, a few other ingredients, and usually rum.
Some people put white rum. I choose Manischewitz because Manischewitz gives it just the right flavor.
Her daughter, Carla Hill, jokes about the time her mom had a girls' night in.
And child, they were pulling out the Manischewitz and glasses, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're about to get lit up in here on some Manischewitz.
My kids feel that I should be drinking something more high class, but this is just good enough class for me.
For the World, Nadege Green, Miami.
And now on to Finland. Dark and cold up there most of the year. Maybe that's why Finland, like many Nordic countries, has some strict alcohol laws. But recently, the Finnish parliament narrowly passed a bill to loosen those laws starting next year. Restaurants, bars, and the government-run Monopoly, the only place where Finns can purchase hard liquor, can now stay open later. And supermarkets will be allowed to sell stronger beer and cider. Many Finns are happy. They say this is long overdue. But critics say it could be a public health problem. Matilda Hellman is a sociologist with the University of Helsinki Center for Research on Addiction, Control, and Governance. So the Finns who are happy about the laws being loosened up, what specifically about past restrictions did they single out the most?
Well, you know, Finnish people tend to see alcohol policy in relation to their own drinking and also as a relationship between the state and the citizen. So against this kind of Nordic welfare view on the state taking care of its population. So these people who are now cheering are people who think that a strict alcohol policy is something that is moralizing people's alcohol use.
That's an interesting tension. Fine if you give us unemployment benefits, but don't tell us how to drink our booze. What is drinking culture really like in Finland? Do people drink at home? Do they go out to bars?
They drink at home, mostly. The total alcohol consumption in pure alcohol is about 10.8 liters per person. And in U.S. gallons, that is around 2.8. It's almost the same as in Maine or in Massachusetts. It's 2.5. And almost 50% of this consumption is beer and over 20% is spirits. And as we have these northern drinking patterns, we are often comparing our own drinking with southern drinking patterns. The countries that produce wines, the style of drinking is a bit different.
And distinguish what Nordic drinking patterns are. What do you mean by that?
It's a dry drinking culture. Basically, you can say that countries close to the polar circle, where it's cold and dark in the winter, they drink distilled or brewed products. And in the southern European, you have a wet drinking culture, which drinks more often, maybe on a daily basis, but with meals. This is the basic division made between alcohol cultures in Europe.
I mean, drinking at home must be really common because I read recently that there is a word in Finnish, I hope I pronounce this right, kausar ikunit. The feeling you get when you're going to get drunk home alone in your underwear with no intention of going out. Is that,
Yes. Kalsarikännit is quite a nice word. It means that there's no pressure on you socially or in any other way. You just feel like sitting on the sofa in your underwear, being drunk at home with no intentions of going out or meeting anybody.
What specifically are critics worried about from a public health standpoint? And do you consider yourself one of those critics?
I do. We have very skillful alcohol researchers in Finland. They have calculated that this will increase the consumption. This will increase the harm caused by alcohol. There's a worry that the decreasing trend of drinking among youngsters will turn and go in the opposite direction. And I think also this is a question that is gendered. Those who are pro a liberalization is often men. So I think this is an aspect that hasn't been enough discussed.
Why do you think Finland is decreasing regulation of alcohol while most countries in the EU are trying to increase regulation?
It has something to do with the question of alcohol being so loaded with emotion in Finland and politically a culture view also on alcohol policy. When you compare to Sweden, where there's more consensus on a public health perspective, in Finland, there's more polarization. You could see that a middle-class, educated, urban population would think that it's good to restrict alcohol, but the right wing and also populist parties are against restrictions. That tells me that we are very divided on this question in Finland, really divided. And this country deviates from the rest of Europe and the rest of the Nordic countries in this way.
That was Matilda Hellman, a sociologist with the University of Helsinki Center for Research on Addiction, Control, and Governance. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. You know, there is a pretty good chance some of you have already done it today. Some of you might be planning it for later. I'm talking about sitting down and playing Trivial Pursuit, still one of the most popular adult board games of all time. And here's some trivia about Trivial Pursuit. The game was dreamt up by two Canadian buddies nearly three decades ago. My BBC colleague Ashley Byrne has been speaking with the game's art designer, Michael Verstlin.
All the games people play
In December 1979, two men from Canada hit on an invention that would go on to sell over 100 million copies across 26 countries.
In a sense, they were reinventing for their own generation the category of games.
Photo editor Chris Haney and sports writer Scott Abbott had no idea at the time that their simple mix of board game and trivia aimed at adults would be such a massive success.
We started doodling. And the game, as we know it today, right down to the precise layout of the board with all 73 spaces, it was all done in about 45 minutes.
It was a game changer. When people saw Trivial Pursuit's success, there was a deluge of games.
Michael Verstlin was 27 years old and unemployed when he first got involved with the creators of the game.
The guy who referred me to them had been a co-employee of mine. I'd been working at a place, and we both got fired. He landed on his feet right away. The guy was offered the job himself, and he said, "I'm too busy," so he gave it to me.
But Michael says Haney and Abbott had a checkered history when it came to creating new products.
I think they had a string of things that they tried to make money out of and had not succeeded. They were sort of serial inventors. Fortunately, I didn't know that about them when I met them. At the time, there were really only children's games, if you include Monopoly and, you know, checkers and stuff like that. I mean, there wasn't anything for grown-ups.
But there were other adult games, surely, like Scrabble.
Yeah, I guess Scrabble was the closest you would come to an adult game, but there wasn't a lot to choose from, really. These guys were the ones for their generation who went, "We need a new game for just us."
The origins of Trivial Pursuit are actually linked to Scrabble, as creator Scott Abbott explained to the BBC in 1995.
We got into a big flap about who was the better Scrabble player, and Chris came home at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and plopped a brown paper bag on the kitchen table and said, "Guess what I have here? I have a Scrabble game, and you wouldn't believe what I paid for it. There must be a lot of money in games. Why don't we invent a game? What could it be about?" And I said, "Trivia."
Michael agreed to design the game for the two inventors on a promise that he would receive two shares in the company worth $500 Canadian each.
I think I gave them two looks. One was sort of an antique circus. I tried to find sort of antique imagery and, you know, as if you found some toys from the long ago, and the colors were quite restrained. And then the second one was curly letters and really simple color palette and borders that were very formal. Just trying to make it look like what an adult might consider classy.
And back in the early 1980s, all of the designs had to be produced without the aid of a computer.
Everything I did was by hand, including the first iteration of cards. You would send the words out to a typesetter, and they'd come back in large galleys, and you had to cut them all up. And of course, since I'm a measure once, cut twice kind of guy, I messed up the whole measurement by about an eighth of an inch, and as a result had to redo all the cards.
Questions from the original edition included: what four countries boast half the world's population? Original answer: China, India, the Soviet Union, and the United States. And what's the capital of Yugoslavia? Original answer: Belgrade. Michael says finding enough trivial facts proved the biggest challenge, some of them coming from unlikely sources.
They're reading every ketchup bottle for little trivia, because a lot of the trivia that they wrote, and I think this was part of the success of the game, was that it was very playful stuff, you know, about movie stars and about curious events in history. And, you know, they had a lot of fun writing the game, writing the questions, and they scoured the world. Again, this was before Google, so they had to do everything by hand.
Did you have a sense at that point of how big it would become?
I really was completely skeptical, and my only hope was that they would pay me the $1,000 that I'd been promised. I read recently that another fella was with his wife, and she told him to not take the shares, and he regrets it very much. My wife, on the other hand, told me to take the shares. So I was lucky in that, but I certainly didn't think I'd ever see the money.
And can you remember where the name came from, Trivial Pursuit?
I know they had like the idea of pursuit, and I think they were going to call it Trivia Pursuit. And I think Chris's wife or one of the wives suggested Trivial Pursuit. And I don't know why she was motivated to do that, but it stuck.
All the games people play now, every night and every day now. I never mean what to say now, never saying what they mean.
The game was officially launched in 1981. Units were sold at a loss to increase distribution, but Michael says Haney and Abbott used all their journalism contacts to make sure Trivial Pursuit would be on everybody's lips.
About a year and a half later, I started reading articles. Because they were in the media, they had all these friends in the media, so they managed to get a lot of their publicity, if not all of it, from their friends writing stories about the game.
And as the game took off around the world, the money began to roll in.
Lo and behold, I finally got a check. I think it was like maybe 2 years in, and it was for $800, which was $200 short of the original amount that I'd asked for. And then I got another check, like I think it was $12,000, and it just completely blew my mind. I was completely shocked. Those shares yielded in the long run, I think, about $1 million, and that was over the course of 25 years.
Since the original launch of Trivial Pursuit, known as the Genius Edition, there's been a Family Edition, All-Star Sports, Baby Boomer, and even a Harry Potter version, to name but a few.
And they had a game show as well, and that was kind of fun. There has to be an app, I'm sure.
And of course, it's also been translated into 17 different languages. Brian Hiley wrote questions for the UK version of Trivial Pursuit back in 1995. He says every country has its own take on the game.
The French like their questions to be exceedingly French. It's got to be about French food, French wine. The Germans are deadly dull. There's no humour at all in the game. They like it to be very, very serious. Now, apparently in Holland, this is the place where you go to see people fighting over a game of Trivial Pursuit because they're very, very, very competitive.
But one question remains. Is the central play piece a pie or a cheese?
I hadn't heard about the pie or cheese debate, and I'm not sure I can give an authoritative answer to that, but we've always referred to it as pie pieces, so. But you guys eat a lot more cheese in England than we do, I think.
Although he's done many other things in his life, Michael believes he will be forever remembered for his work on Trivial Pursuit.
They'll put it on my gravestone, which is really embarrassing because I've done so much more. But you know what? I'm still, at the end of the day, the Trivial Pursuit guy, which is kind of lame, but at the same time, it's great.
Well, I say pie. Trivial Pursuit art designer Michael Wurstlin there, speaking with Ashley Byrne of the BBC's Witness program. I'm Marco Werman. A fortune cookie so good you'll want to eat the slip of paper inside, apparently.
People eat fortunes?
Yes.
What are you talking about? Nobody eats the little paper fortune in the fortune cookie. Really?
Some people actually only think it comes true if they eat them.
That wonderful story still ahead. Our Christmas gift to you today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. And for the rest of the show today, we're going to do something we did last Thanksgiving. We fork the program over to our language podcast, The World in Words. We regularly feature excerpts from the podcast on The World, but today we're going to bring you a full-length, never-before-heard-on-the-radio episode of The World in Words. So without further ado, let's bring in podcast producers Lydia Jean Cott and Nina Porzucchi. Hey, you two.
Hey, Marco.
Hi. So, Marco, when you get off work, which is going to be any minute now, what you going to do for dinner?
Oh, we're going to do what we do every Christmas, which is the family and I go to Chinatown for some dumplings. It's a ritual. I love it.
Sounds pretty good to me. Another question.
Yes.
What is the most common component of Chinese meals in America?
Duck sauce? MSG?
Close. Think the end of the meal.
Oh, right. The fortune cookie.
Exactly. So sit back, Marco, because Lydia, Jean, and I are taking over the rest of the show with a Christmas story of edible intrigue.
And stolen fortunes.
Ooh.
But I want to begin with a big question about fortune cookies in general. Why are fortune cookie fortunes never actually fortunes?
So I actually went to New York to ask a fortune writer that, and that's where our story starts.
Part one. Some men dream of fortunes, others dream of cookies.
We're not actual fortune tellers. What we like to do is just to give people advice and possibly make them smile.
That's James Wong. He's in his mid-40s and super smiley. He became the official fortune writer at Wonton Food, the biggest fortune cookie company in the U.S., a year ago. The writer before him, Donald Lau, he had to step down because he said he got writer's block. And writing fortunes, it's actually, okay, it's really hard because the fortunes, they have to apply to everyone. They have to be positive. And there has to be no possible conceivable way that they could be construed as offensive. Otherwise, people complain. Still, even though Wonton tries really hard with all of their messages to be basically keep everyone happy, there have still been fortunes that have gone really wrong.
This one that immediately comes to mind.
A couple, a husband and wife, went out for dinner and they opened their cookies together.
The fortune that he got was romance is in the air on your next trip.
Romance is in the air on your next trip. Unfortunately, he was about to leave on a business trip.
We heard from the lady's lawyer that she's actually blaming everything that happened, that went wrong with the marriage on us.
That can't be true, okay. Lydia Jean. That is insane.
Okay, Nina, I said that. I told them I didn't think it was true. But they insisted that it was. It was him and a PR person that was there. And they said that fortune ended up getting removed from circulation because of it. Anyways, regardless, the story definitely indicates the stakes. People take their fortunes seriously. And Wong is always writing. He jots down fortunes on gum wrappers, napkins. Sometimes he told me toilet paper.
Oh my gosh.
And the hardest part, he said, is keeping up with the demand.
I've been being pressured to be more productive, to write more. It's not as easy as probably some people would think.
Wonton produces 4.5 million fortune cookies a day. Like, can
million?
You, yeah. I mean, I can't really conceive of that number, but the demand for new fortunes, I think, might outstrip the number of positive universal messages that it's possible to come up with.
Oh, it's a really troubling problem.
And that might explain why fortune cookie fortune theft might be tempting.
Part two. The only sure thing about luck is that it will change.
That little clock you hear? That's the sound of a fortune getting inserted into a fortune cookie in Wonton's factory out in Long Island. Yong-Shik Lee invented this machine, or at least its predecessor. He filed a patent for the first fully automatic fortune cookie machine in 1981. This machine, it revolutionized the industry. But Lee himself, he's pretty much gone out of business. Here's his story. First off, Lee's not actually Chinese. He's a Korean-American engineer who lives outside of Boston. He's about 80 now. And he used to sell fortune cookie machines and also fortunes to go along with them. He innovated in that field, too. He's the guy who added the smiley faces. Then, in the late 90s, a disgruntled employee of his photocopied his fortunes, stole his customers, and started his own company out in San Francisco. I tried to get in touch with Lee a bunch of times to ask him about what exactly happened between him and the fortune cookie thief.
Hello. Please leave a message after the tone.
After a couple of weeks, Lee sent me an email saying this. I have given many interviews more than 30 years ago. At that time, fortune cookies were not known. Fortune cookies became an American phenomenon. And now all Americans know about fortune cookies. I don't want the publicity anymore. I get it, I wrote back. But did you have a former employee who stole your customers, copied your fortunes, and overtook your business? A couple hours later, he responded, many guys had gone through me. I treasure to remember only the good ones.
Forgiveness does not change the past, but it does enlarge the future.
Okay, yeah, but I wanted an actual answer. Yangshik Li has a son named David Li, who used to help out with the company. Now he lives out in LA, he's a former Google exec, and he's a super big deal tech investor. Like, if you Google his name, you find people saying, how can I get in touch with David Li? So I guess I was luckier than most, since David Li responded to me, agreeing to a Skype date to talk about his father's business. But he stood me up. Twice. We finally connected one day as he was leaving work and getting into his Uber.
Hi, Lydia. How are you?
I'm so good. How are you?
Good. I am so sorry about all the back and forth. So you get an A in persistence for sure.
I told David that I had read about how his father had had this employee who had copied his fortunes, stolen his customers, and overtaken his business. So then I also asked your dad about this, and he said he didn't remember, but did that all happen?
If that's what my dad said, I'm going to have to respect his wishes. He probably just doesn't want to talk about it. For sure, like, I think any great technology, there are going to be copycats and there's going to be competition.
And that was all he'd tell me.
Part 3. The riches of others make you more valuable.
Fortune cookies? They wouldn't even exist in America were it not for this other theft. One that happened years and years ago. There's this famous shrine in Japan, and it's called the Fushimi Inari Shrine. And the street leading up to it, it's full of these like little family-run bakeries, and these bakeries sell all sorts of cookies, including fortune cookies. Because fortune cookies aren't actually Chinese. They originated in Japan. Takeshi Matsuhisa works at one of these bakeries called Sahonke Hagyokudo. It's actually one of the oldest. Takeshi says he learned how to fold fortunes from his father, who learned from his father, and so on and so on.
Wow, that is amazing. I guess I really always knew that they didn't have fortune cookies in China, but I always thought it was a Chinese-American invention. I had zero idea that it started in Japan. Are the Japanese fortunes cookies just like American ones?
Yeah, they're basically the same. I mean, they're a little larger and they taste a little less sweet, but the main difference has to do with the fortunes. There's way fewer of them. Sahonke Hagyokudo has been using the same 30 fortunes for decades.
Oh my god.
So yeah, fortune cookie writer's block, it's not really a problem in Japan.
But aren't people disappointed if they get the same fortune over and over and over again?
No, apparently getting the same fortune twice just means you were really meant to get that fortune.
What kind of things do these 30 fortunes say?
Well, they're like these little lines of poetry. They're pretty hard to translate because they're written in old-fashioned Japanese, and they have a lot of puns.
Do you have an example?
Well, there's this one, and this is a very rough translation. Bow your head when speaking to others so their opinions go over your head.
Okay, I'll take it. How then did Japanese fortunes come all the way to the U.S. and become associated with Chinese restaurants?
So it all started with the gold rush.
Got a dream boy, got a song, paint your wagon and come along.
In 1848, people from all over the world came to California, hoping to make their literal fortunes. And a lot of those people, they came from China. That song, by the way, it's from a really racist musical from the 60s called Paint Your Wagon.
Wow, yeah.
So then, as often happens after big waves of immigrations like this, an anti-immigrant backlash followed. And there weren't very many jobs open to Chinese immigrants, except in the restaurant business. So that's actually why there's so many Chinese restaurants all over the U.S. now.
How then did the Chinese restaurants start serving these Japanese fortune cookies?
When the Japanese immigrated to the U.S., they opened up Chinese restaurants too. It was just easier that way. People knew about Chinese food. There were the ingredients there. And then because, you know, Americans love dessert, they started giving out fortune cookies at the end of meals. But then World War II broke out.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
After the Pearl Harbor attack, President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order forcibly relocating hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans into internment camps all across the U.S. Some were forced to stay as long as 4 years. And by the time the Japanese were allowed to return to their homes, the Chinese had overtaken the fortune cookie business.
One more question, though. Remember Yongsik Lee, the guy who invented the first fully automatic fortune cookie machine? You know, the guy who had his fortune stolen? What happened to the fortune cookie thief?
Part 4. A hero is a man who does what he can.
So who stole Lee's fortunes?
Well, he's now a West Coast fortune cookie magnate. And his name? It's Stephen Yang.
Hello?
Hi, is this Stephen Yang?
Yeah?
Hi, how are you? This is Lydia Jean. I'm working on a story about fortune cookies. But this is not the part where I catch the fortune cookie thief.
I'm a little bit busy right now. So can we talk another time?
I called back again and again, but Yang was always busy. Or at least he never answered. There's this other guy, though, and he did meet with Yang almost 2 decades ago. And after their conversation, well, fortune cookies, I'm not going to say they were never quite the same, but they were different, at least for a while. On November 4th, 2000, something dreadful has happened to fortune cookies, read the front page of the LA Times. The fortunes had turned dark. People in LA and all over the West Coast were getting messages like,
"Choose your enemies wisely." Pain indicates injury, while a painful sensation indicates growth. Learn to distinguish between them. After today, you shall have a deeper understanding of both good and evil.
The man responsible for these dark and distressing fortunes was a soft-spoken novelist, originally from Montana, named Russell Rowland. He heard about a job writing fortunes from a friend, so he applied.
It was just the weirdest experience. The interview basically lasted about 5 minutes. He said, "Do you want to do it?" And I was like, "Okay." He was just desperate, basically.
That desperate man was Stephen Yang, fortune cookie thief and current fortune cookie baron. You know, the one that won't answer my calls. He commissioned Roland to write him 1,000 fortunes at around like 70 cents a fortune. I don't know the going rate for fortunes, but that doesn't seem like a lot. Anyways, Roland took the job because he could use the extra cash. But even more than that, he could use the distraction. He had just sold his first book to a publishing company, and that company had gone under, and he had no idea what was going to happen to his book.
I was kind of a mess, you know, a nervous wreck about whether it was ever going to get published.
So was that like a dark period in your life, the fortune
company? Yeah, it was. I guess it showed in my fortunes.
Roland cribbed a lot of the messages from books, especially this one called The Great Thoughts, that's full of quotes from, like, thinkers who helped shape the Western world.
All the famous ones, Plato and Voltaire and even politicians. I mean, this book was just full of great quotes. Mark Twain, the whole deal.
A hero is a man who does what he can.
French playwright Romain Rolland.
Words are the only things that last forever.
English essayist William Hazlitt. But Roland had more messages to write than there were great thoughts to steal.
When I got to the last couple hundred, I was so burned out on it that I would just take a phrase like, "Love is the secret to happiness," and I would cut and paste different words in there. So it was, you know, serenity is the secret to happiness, family is the secret to happiness. I just, I was just cranking out a bunch that were pretty similar. Words
don't come easy. Roland never did make it to 1,000 fortunes. He stopped at 700. Words don't come easy. Russell Roland went on to become a well-respected and successful author. Still, his most widely read work, and the one that had the greatest impact on the American psyche, was that set of disconcerting fortune cookie messages that he wrote back when he thought that maybe he would never even make it as a writer. As Roland wrote me in an email,
"The twists of fate are very unpredictable."
Oh, you shouldn't actually be reading that. I don't think that fortune ever made it into a cookie.
Coming up, Lydia Jean confronts the fortune cookie thief on The World. I'm Nina Borzucchi.
And I'm Lydia Jean Cott.
And this is The World. Today, we're featuring an episode of our podcast, The World in Words, and we're out to catch a fortune cookie thief.
Part 5.
you will be unusually successful in business.
So this is a leafy, kind of more quiet street, but it's not his street yet, is it?
I think we're definitely approaching.
My heart's kind of racing. Having exhausted all of my options, I flew 3,000 miles from Boston to San Francisco, hoping to talk to Stephen Yang, the fortune cookie thief, in person. My friend Annie Hollister agreed to come with, ostensibly to hold the mic, but actually to calm my nerves.
There's 501A. 501B.
Okay, here we are. We arrived at what looked like an office building. It was white, pagoda style. All the windows were shuttered.
Entrance at back of building. Yeah, that's not great.
501 Mendel Street, Unit B, entrance at back of building. That's
all
not
right.
Very promising.
Well, let's try.
Okay. Around back, there was a parking lot and a garage. The door was left half open.
Oh, look at those boxes, though.
The garage was filled with cardboard boxes, so many that it would have been impossible to close the door without some serious rearranging. And next to one of the boxes, I noticed a little white rectangular slip of paper.
I think those slips.
Oh my God, yes! There are fortunes all over the floor.
This is it.
Stephen Yang, turns out, was just having lunch next door.
Can I come in?
Yeah. Please.
Yang is more soft-spoken and more welcoming than I expected.
You can come inside, please.
He runs this company with his wife. Five people work here total. Pretty much all the fortunes in America that don't come from Wonton, that company in New York, they come from this warehouse. They weren't written here necessarily. Most companies at this point have their own stockpiles of fortunes, but they send in their orders, and the fortunes get printed here, cut up, and shipped off. The hardest part is the cutting.
Whole days cutting paper.
Like from what time in the morning?
Yeah. 8:30 morning, 5:30 finish.
And you spend the whole day cutting?
Whole day cutting.
Yang showed me a sheet of paper with messages from Panda Express before they've been cut up into fortunes. Yang took us from the cutting room to the garage, where boxes of fortunes are waiting to get shipped to companies all over the United States and also abroad.
I have three customers in Canada. I have one customer in Germany. Also one in French.
So, this ancient Japanese cookie that became known as a Chinese dessert in America is now getting served in American-style Chinese restaurants in Germany. Annie and I, by the way, had been strategizing for days about how to ask Yang if he stole Lee's fortunes.
You used to live in Boston, right?
We brought up Boston any chance we got.
I live in Boston.
But actually, Yang seemed to want to tell us about Boston.
You know Boston, under a company called United Automatic Technology in Boston.
That sells fortune cookie machines?
Korea people.
Yeah. I know that.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive, yeah.
Oh, he's still alive.
Yang got quiet. But when he started talking again, it was like he was telling us about something that had happened just the other day, as opposed to over two decades ago.
You know, I tried selling a machine for this guy.
Yang worked for Lee as a salesman. He says he would find customers and sell them Lee's newfangled machines. And then the customers would go back to Lee over and over again to get refills on fortunes. Yang felt taken advantage of. He felt like he was putting in all this work, finding customers for Lee, and all he got was this one commission, while Lee was set for years.
I'm saying, you're smart. I find a customer, sell a war machine, then she goes to you. Right?
So, Yang decided to start his own business, selling fortune cookie fortunes for cheaper than Lee's. And yes, to start things off, he stole Lee's fortunes.
First time I got a fortune from a Boston guy.
You got his fortunes?
I'm copying it.
You copied them?
I'm copying the fortune, then I sell it.
Copied and sold them. Yang says he doesn't feel like he did anything wrong. To the contrary, he's proud. He feels like he won.
Was the Boston guy, was he mad that you copied
his fortune? Oh, she mad, of course. I don't care. Not all market is mine. Not Boston guy. Boston guy is no more.
But the end of the Boston guy was not the end of Yang's problems. Yang didn't tell us what those stolen fortunes said, but he said as his company grew, he started getting negative feedback about typos, grammatical mistakes, repeats, etc.
So many complaining. People, they complain, this is no good, she said. This is not fortune.
That's why Yang hired Russell Rowland to write more fortunes. You know, bummer fortune guy.
Pay less attention to your living conditions and more attention to your life.
That didn't go great either. So Yang shifted focus from producing fortunes to printing and cutting them. Companies turned to him because he uses this special non-toxic ink and non-toxic paper that's pretty hard to get. So if people eat their fortunes, nothing bad will happen to them.
Wait a second. People eat fortunes?
Yes.
What are you talking about? Nobody eats the little paper fortune in the fortune cookie. Really?
Some people actually only think it comes true if they eat them.
Oh, God.
Anyways, he told me that he likes the work. What do you like about your job? Why do you like it?
Yeah, you know what? No competition. Just cut it. Sell it.
Are there other businesses that are
no.
the same?
You're the only one.
Only one. No competition.
At least for now. But as Lee's son said back when I asked him if someone stole his dad's fortunes.
I think any great technology, there are going to be copycats and there's going to be competition.
I realize now, though, or at least I think, that what he was trying to say is that that's okay. That's how things get better, even. And that's why his dad was willing to let this whole thing go. I mean, stealing those fortunes, it was definitely a little ethically dubious on Yang's part. But doesn't every innovation, every piece of art, every fortune cookie fortune owe something to what came before it? I think my conclusion after all this is that it's not where you take things from, but where you take them to. And yes, I stole that. And to do this story, I stole a lot from a lot of different people. Thanks to Terry McDermott, whose LA Times article, The Sage of Fortune Cookies, led me to the story of Russell Rowland. Thank you to Jennifer Haight Lee, the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, all of the history I got from her book. And thank you to Gwendolina Fanti for going to that bakery in Japan and sending us back that audio. Plus, also thanks to Patrick Cox for being the disembodied voice of Fortune Cookies over the past 25 minutes.
To Catch a Fortune Cookie Thief was originally an episode on our language podcast, The World in Words. You can subscribe to The World in Word podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or tweet us at LingoPod.
Marco Werman is back tomorrow. Until then, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lydia Jean Cott.
And I'm Nina Porzucchi. And we'll leave you with this bit of wisdom. A foolish man listens to his heart. A wise man listens to his cookie.
PRI, Public Radio International.